The final of the panels in this symposium is entitled Disability Discrimination in Healthcare, and we have two people for presentations on this. They are Jane Perkins and Sylvia Yee. Jane Perkins is the legal director of the National Health Law Program. A public interest law firm working for low-income people and individuals with disabilities. Her work focuses on Medicaid, particularly the early and periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment program, and discrimination in the delivery of health care. Sylvia Yee is a senior staff attorney at Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, DREDIF, where her work has included projects to increase physical and programmatic accessibility and disability awareness in the delivery of healthcare services. For the first part of the presentation, here is Jane Perkins.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I want to focus on some of the litigation that we have been engaged in over the last few years. Our office engages in both policy and litigation advocacy. I think with the Supreme Court case sitting, I guess I don't know what my directions are, that way, and really I think illustrating the important role that litigation plays in healthcare, That's why I want to focus on litigation rather than policy, some of our policy work today. We are focusing a lot at InHelp on cutbacks in services. It's nice to be engaged in efforts to expand the reach of laws and to have them fully enforced, but unfortunately our phone is ringing more often than not because a service that people need and that they have been getting is being cut back or even eliminated by the Medicaid program. There's also a tremendous number of service delivery changes with managed care coming into populations that have not previously been required to enroll people with disabilities. I have to digress to say that when I got to InHelp, back in the 1980s, my first case was one in Minnesota. And Minnesota is a leader in managed care. And the people were being enrolled kind of en masse in these managed care companies, and they didn't really know what was going on. And so I went up there, and the very first thing that I had put in my hands was a notice telling people that they were being enrolled in a managed care plan. And at the bottom, literally at the bottom of the notice, it said, "If you are blind or are having trouble reading this notice, please call the following number." And I wish I could say that it had gotten a little more sophisticated since then, but it never ceases to amaze me what happens. So what I'm going to do is just focus on a few of the cases that we've had in the office so that I can illustrate, in particular, the Medicaid provisions that we're dealing with and trying to enforce. These cases do have ADA components, particularly Title II components, but I want to focus on the Medicaid ones because I think that Medicaid is a civil rights law, and Medicaid is an anti-discrimination law, and it's important to think of it in that way. So Steve Hildebrand is a client that we have in Missouri. He is 23. He has multiple conditions, medical conditions, chronic disabilities. He is medically incontinent of both bowel and bladder. Until he was 21, his records showed that he had a medical necessity for incontinence supplies. When he turned 21, his incontinence supplies became personal hygiene items and were no longer covered by the Medicaid program. Now, he could go into a nursing facility for the purpose of getting the incontinence supplies. But you see how non-commonsensical or just nonsensical that would be when you're talking about $86 every couple of months versus going into a nursing facility. Bobby Hall is another client that we have. He lives in North Carolina. He's an older man. He also has a number of chronic conditions. He takes a number of medications. He has been found by the state's utilization reviewers to qualify for the level of care in an institutional setting, but he can live very well at home with personal care services, with personal care attendant services. And he was getting these services for a couple of years under the standard that North Carolina was applying, and that was if you need assistance with two or more activities of daily living, bathing, toilet, those kinds of things, then you could qualify for personal care services. He was receiving them in June. Just this past June, North Carolina changed the law and said from now on, to get personal care services in your home, you have to need assistance with three activities of daily living, and you have to have a physician prescribe the need for the personal care services. Mr. Hall lost all of his personal care services. Now, his situation was a particularly unfortunate one because his health deteriorated pretty quickly. He fell. He ended up in the hospital with a fairly prolonged hospital stay. He could have gotten the personal care services that he was receiving if he would agree to go into an adult care home. In North Carolina, while they changed the rule for getting personal care services in the home, they left the rule the same if you would go into an adult care home to get the service. And so there you could continue, and today you can get personal care services if you need assistance with two activities of daily living and an employee of the adult care home says you need the service. So you don't have to have a physician certify your need. Now, in North Carolina, and I'm not sure if it's this way in other places, but in North Carolina, adult care homes are pretty large congregate settings. They are 80-bed, up to 220-bed facilities. So it isn't a 4-bed residential-type setting that you would be going to, that Mr. Hall would be going to. It's institutional. You can't really come and go as you please. They will use restraints. They set meal times. When you go somewhere in the community, you go in a bus with everybody else. So it's an institutional setting, and he didn't want to go there. And as you could see from his story in deteriorating and ending up in the hospital after a fall, he was really willing to risk a lot to stay out of that type of institutional setting. So these two stories from Missouri and North Carolina really illustrate what is going on with Medicaid cutbacks. State Medicaid agencies are trimming home-based services, personal care services, home health services, medical equipment and supplies. They're cutting back or eliminating transportation services. They're really focusing in on these items to try to save money with the economic recessions that are going on. We brought along with others lawsuits in both of these states, and we've ended up with injunctions. And I want to just go through the Medicaid statutes that the courts are enforcing here, because they're ones that, again, I think if you don't work with them already, when you hear them, you'll see that they really are good anti-discrimination provisions. The first statute is one that requires state agencies to have reasonable standards. And if you, just to take Steve Hildebrand's situation, it doesn't really sound reasonable if on the day you turn 22 years old, you lose incontinence supplies because they are now a personal hygiene item as opposed to something that's a medically necessary item. It's not really reasonable for you to go into an institutional setting and pay a bajillion, whatever the number would be that I don't know the name of, more than it costs to get incontinence supplies at home. That's just not reasonable. And indeed, that's what this court said. It's not reasonable to cut it like that. It just makes no sense. There's also a requirement in the law. It's called comparability, and it says that you have to treat everybody the same. So if you have people with disabilities, people who are aged, blind, and disabled, you can't treat one group of them one way and another group the other way. You can't treat some people with disabilities in a way that makes it easier for them to get the service than you do others. And that's what Mr. Hall's situation illustrates. If you're a person with a disability in an adult care home, you're going to get the service on a less demanding standard than if you are living in your home to get the service. Another claim that we brought, and this is one that those other two are ones that have been litigated. I'm not sure this other one had been previously. There is a provision in the Medicaid law that says that if you are entitled to nursing facility care, then home health care is a mandatory service for you. And home health services, a mandatory component of home health services include medical equipment and supplies. So in Steve Hildebrand's case, we argued that because he was a person with a disability, he automatically qualified for Medicaid. He was what's called categorically needy. He's somebody that if a state has a Medicaid program, it has to cover people like Steve Hildebrand. And the state covered nursing facility services, so he's entitled to nursing facility services. He may not be applying for a nursing home today, but he is under the law entitled to those services should he need them. As a result, we argued, he is entitled to home health services and thus medical equipment that he needs, medical equipment and supplies, which include incontinence supplies. And the court agreed. The court said that on the face of that law, he qualifies. So this is another reason why under Medicaid, he gets this service and the state can't do what it was planning to do. So reasonable standards, comparability, and mandatory home health are three really important Medicaid laws that prevent discrimination in health care. Now, as I mentioned, both of these cases had an ADA component. It's an obvious one. If you go to the institution, you get it. If you agree to live in a segregated setting, you'll get the service. You don't get it if you want to stay in a home or community setting. Another example of a case that we've had recently involves a child named D.W. He lives in West Virginia. He has a number of really serious disabling conditions, a number of behavioral health conditions. In West Virginia, is anybody here from West Virginia? The state I guess you would literally say the closing moments of the Bush administration got a waiver, special permission to set up a different kind of Medicaid program. And what it did was move most everyone into a managed care plan. And I'm not wanting to be saying that managed care is a bad thing, but managed care can be a bad thing. And in this situation, what happened is that these children, like DW, were enrolled in managed care plans that weren't familiar with the Medicaid requirements for covering services for children. And so he went into this plan. He wasn't getting screening under mandatory Medicaid service called EPSDT, Early and Periodic Screening, Diagnosis, and Treatment. Every President Should Destroy Tapes is how we remember the letters in the right order. Every child gets periodic screening, dental, vision, including eyeglasses, hearing, including hearing aids, and dental vision, hearing, and medical. And the medical screen includes a developmental and physical assessment. Well, DW wasn't getting that. He and his family didn't even know what EPSDT was. And I think it had a catchy name like Healthy Families or Smiling Children or something like that. And they did not know what it was. So it just was on the books, but not doing what it should do. He actually ended up in, we came to know of him because he ended up being handcuffed and removed from school because he was having a problem at school. They wouldn't let him go back to school, and so we then became involved. And of course, we were saying there's that issue of the school, but there's also this issue of if he had been getting what he was entitled to through EPSDT, that is periodic screening to identify health and developmental problems, then he also would have been getting through EPSDT the treatment that he needed. And under EPSDT, you get a really broad array of treatment services, both home and community and institutionally based services, if they're needed to correct or ameliorate the problem that you have. And so what we did in this case was to say, you can have your system, but you can't ignore EPSDT. You have to inform families of it. You need to train providers about what it is. And you need to make sure that children are getting in for the screening services that they need and are entitled to. Managed care soups up that requirement that much more because, in contrast to fee-for-service, which we like to say is a hunting license to go out and hunt for a provider who will take Medicaid rates, when you have a fee-for-service, when you have a managed care setting, the health plan is being paid ahead of time to provide you the services that you need when you need them, so long as they're listed in the contract. And so here we were arguing, DW is in this plan. He doesn't know what managed care was. He's not a smiling child. He is he's decompensating. He's not getting what he needs. Meanwhile, this plan is being paid a certain amount of money per member per month and not doing what they should be with it. In all those cases, we obtained injunctions that stopped the state from doing what it was doing. And I'm not going to say that it's easy once you get an injunction, it all goes away. It certainly doesn't, and I'm sure all of you who do this kind of work are well aware of that. But it does help change the dynamic. Medicaid is a really important component in the fight against discrimination in healthcare, which is why I want to close with talking just for a couple minutes about the case that's pending before the Supreme Court right now. In late March, the Supreme Court heard oral argument over a three-day period on four issues. The issue that has been getting a lot of attention is the individual responsibility requirement, also known as the individual mandate requirement. It is the part of the law that sort of anchors or makes the heart of the Affordable Care Act work, the heart of it being the requirements that insurance companies issue insurance policies and price them at an affordable price. So it's guarantee issue and community rating. And that's the part that's gotten, I think, a lot of the attention. When you think about, I'm not saying that it's not really important, it is quite important, but there are some workarounds that can be used if the individual mandate fell as the anchor for making guarantee issue and community rating work. You could use required enrollment, just annual enrollment periods to, would be one example, just so that people would be afraid to go naked for a year. And so they would come into the coverage. So there are some workarounds there. Wouldn't be as good, probably, as what the individual responsibility requirement is to do. It's worked in Massachusetts. But there are workarounds. One of the issues that the court considered was the constitutionality of a provision in the law that expands Medicaid. It makes people who are non-disabled, non-elderly adults, essentially, with incomes up to around 133% of the poverty level, eligible for Medicaid. And this provision has really not gotten a lot of not the kind of attention that the individual mandate did. 26 Republican governors and attorneys general are arguing that this Medicaid expansion up to 133% for this group of people is unconstitutionally coercive, that Congress didn't have the authority under the spending clause to enact this provision. They are saying that the financial incentive to participate in Medicaid is just too great for the states to walk away from, and they're relying on dicta in a couple of Supreme Court cases that said that the inducements that are being offered by a program like Medicaid could be so coercive as to pass the point at which pressure turns into compulsion. Now, those were essentially, they were statements, phrases made in two cases. They were not, no, the Supreme Court has never applied the coercion doctrine, has never formulated a coercion doctrine. No circuit court has ever applied or formulated a coercion doctrine. And the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in this case found that the Medicaid expansion was not coercive. Not surprising, it pays for the expansion 100% federal funded for the first years and 90% thereafter. Nevertheless, four justices were interested enough in this, at least four justices were interested enough in this provision to want to hear it and get argument on it. And so it is very much in play as part of this case whose decision we expect in June. If the Medicaid expansion is held to be unconstitutional, it is really hard to see how the court could draw a line that would not sweep not only this provision along with it, but much of the remainder and perhaps even all, as Justice Breyer pointed out during the oral arguments, of the Medicaid Act. It is hard to see how it would not also sweep along other programs that are similarly constructed that affect education, transportation, prisons. So I want to just, I guess, want to do something and can't because they are going to do what they're going to do. But let me just say that if the Medicaid expansion falls, it is going to take away a lifeline for 16 million Americans who would get new coverage. It will have to affect the lifeline that is affecting millions and millions of other Americans who depend on Medicaid right now. It's going to affect the insurance industry because most of these people are going to be enrolled in private managed care plans. It's going to affect hospitals because they're going to have to bear uncompensated care that would have been paid for by the Medicaid program. It's going to affect the states, 13 of whom wrote a brief supporting the constitutionality of the Medicaid expansion. This is a highly political situation. I was able to go to the oral argument, and I thought I was sitting in Congress. By the way the questions were being asked. It was highly political. So I guess in closing, I would say that these are very difficult times. We don't know what's happening half the time. I don't know that we ever have, but we certainly don't know what's happening half the time now. But as we stand here today, Medicaid has a number of provisions in it that protect against discrimination in healthcare and aren't meaningful if they're just written on paper. They have to be enforced.
Excellent.